The Shaggy Jenkins Show.
We have to make Russia great again.
On the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to it. Today, we have got a lot to cover, including the most unlikely hero of the free press. China and U.S.'s war could stop, well, expansion in rural areas tech-wise. Plus, we'll talk a little bit about the history of Adam Schiff and the guy Richard Nixon called his executioner. That's all coming up. Well, before we get into all of that, welcome to my show. My name is Shaggy Jenkins. I'm a critical thinker, a problem solver, guy just left of normal insane, but always centered in common sense and found at my website, shaggyjenkins.com, or wherever fine, well, radio programs are heard, including services like Spotify and iHeartMedia. Hi, boy, do we have a big one to start with today. Can we talk a little bit about how right now the free press and an open media in the United States is under attack? And can we also talk about how we have the most unlikely rallying point ever? Okay, first let me explain. Since his time as a candidate, Donald Trump has referred to a free and open press in the United States as enemies of the people or enemies of the state. Now, the problem with this is that that's not what the First Amendment says, Donald. You see, back in the day when the founding fathers were coming together to form this country, they kind of had a little incident that happened earlier that inspired, in large part, all of the protections of the press that were put into our First Amendment. But Donald Trump, well, doesn't know history and doesn't really care about the First Amendment because as long as it's not being used to glorify him, well, it's a bad thing. And see, the First Amendment basically assures that you have the freedom to say something good or something bad about somebody as long as it's not falsified in a thing called slander or libel, which is a whole legal territory that I'm not going to get into because this is just news. And at the end of the day, if news comes out that's bad against an administration, well, we shouldn't really have to fear getting houses raided or well, other kind of crazy stuff that you see in other countries. But the United States here recently, through one particular case, might actually be showing the world we don't care that much about protecting the media. Let me explain. Not too long ago in a world far, far away, back in the early 2000s when we were still optimistic, there was a website that came along and started kind of causing a little bit of a ruckus. Now, the website in question is, of course, WikiLeaks. And then later, through an officer by the name of Manning, here's the thing. WikiLeaks released data and documents that showed that the United States was complicit into some pretty horrible acts. Some war crimes, as it were. And as such, it raised some very hefty questions that we as a country had to wrestle with for a while. Now, the officer, Manning, of course, Chelsea Manning, became a little bit of a rallying point as far as, look, we should be able to protect whistleblowers. And that's, of course, why Barack Obama, as he was getting ready to leave office, decided to commute the remainder of Chelsea Manning's 35-year sentence, basically saying that the United States should, after a time of being a little bit angry, realize that it was wrong and forgive the people that are trying to keep us on the path of right. Now, Manning had an accomplice in distributing this data and documents through the guise of one Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And, well, that's had a strange effect ever since it went down. You'll remember that Julian Assange was already on the run in Europe before the big Manning release happened. And then after it happened, well, he tried to seek asylum at a bunch of countries until finally Ecuador took him in their UK embassy. where he had lived all the way through until, well, he was arrested not too long ago. Now, right now, Julian Assange is in custody inside of the UK jails, and it looks like the United States is preparing a pretty laser-focused case on being able to extradite him to answer for charges here in the United States. Those charges have to do with the Manning docs release. But here's the thing. It depends on how you consider Julian Assange. Is he a publication? Is he a journalist? Is he just some crazy guy with a skateboarding habit inside of Ecuadorian embassy? Well, those questions are going to have a lot more important. Well, not the skateboarding questions, obviously, but those questions about whether or not he's a publication, a media guy, or an actual journalist are going to come into play for the United States case. You see, as they're filing for these extradition charge or extradition request, they're having to go to the UK, and the UK has already balked at the United States extradition once before in the case of McKinnon. You'll remember that from a while back. Look, at that time, Theresa May said releasing their suspect to the United States, yeah, that's right, that Theresa May, basically said that it would have violated his human rights. And it may come up again, that precedent set back then by Theresa May come up again when it comes to Julian Assange. You see, in the UK, Assange is mostly considered a whistleblowing media hero. In other words, a journalist. And as a journalist, he's kind of afforded certain protections, at least in the eyes of UK citizens. So when the United States came forward and says, you know what, we're going to charge him under the Espionage Act, a lot of people in the UK did a collective gasp and said, I don't know about this. Once again, we have a history with you, United States, going back to, well, pre-United States, about this whole what is a journalist right? What can be said? Where can it be said? And what are the protections in place around it? Now, the United States, as much as you know that we love our First Amendment rights, at least if you spend any time on social media, in a country that is supposed to be so in love with a free and open media, we put that as the First Amendment in our Bill of Rights. Well, we might actually be the bad guys here in the Europeans' eye. You see, Julian Assange, in their mind, all he did was took a couple of classified documents and put them up for everybody to look at. Those documents, of course, detailed some pretty horrendous acts by the United States. Some would even consider some of the things war crimes. However, here in the United States, especially Donald Trump, Julian Assange is a little bit of a polarizing figure. The guy who was once the darling of Trump now seems to be the target of Trump. You see, Julian Assange was originally only supposed to be charged with a little bit of classified document stuff. How do I say this? The legal equivalent of sharing your Netflix password with your father in another state. Not that I'm admitting to anything. Moving on, though, that's the basic first thing that the United States came to with Julian Assange. Rightfully, avoiding any sort of conspiracy or espionage charges. The reason why, once again, to a lot of people, the definition of what Julian Assange is a journalist. Now, keep in mind, he's also an alleged rapist, and he doesn't have exactly the most cleanest records of using his power of disclosure for good. Julian Assange is quite possibly the very worst person for us to frame a debate around a free and open media. But it looks like we have to. Because here's the thing. While he's been kind of complicit in publishing classified information, a lot of supporters basically say that, is it okay to release information that does disclose war crimes that are trying to be covered up actively by your government. In other words, being a whistleblower. The other thing is that they kind of wonder where these other charges come in. You see, the first charge that they had against Julian Assange was light, but now they added in 17 counts under an Espionage Act of 1917. Now, this was passed after World War I, and before you go Googling it and look it up, let me just go ahead and tell you, it was a political weapon. Essentially, the Espionage Act of 1917 was the war on drugs to Nixon. It was a way of targeting anti-war activists and people that were dissidents to the agenda of the White House. Now, the government has basically said, look, Julian Assange is a very, very bad man and give in to it. However, counts 9 through 17 on that are basically just publications of national defense information. Now, the Justice Department does try to take some sort of care to argue that Assange is not a journalist and that the publication counts basically is a disclosure of not just classified information, but for intelligent sources that did endanger lives. Now, keep in mind, they're saying he's not a journalist, and that is something that might be hard to prove. You see, Julian Assange, once again, not the exact person that I would envision this argument being about, might not be a good journalist. He just might be kind of a pretty bad one. And being a bad journalist versus being a non-journalist who's just throwing out classified documents for fun has a very, very, very high legal consequence. You see, if Julian Assange is viewed as a journalist, his actions can be protected, some under the First Amendment, some under Whistleblower Protection Act. But if not, well, the Justice Department would basically be able to hold him to any sort of crime they wanted to under the specter of what they've charged and use that as a precedent to start investigating domestic journalists here in the United States. Think about that. Julian Assange's case could basically weaponize the Department of Justice under a president who calls the media the enemy of the state against journalists in America. Now, keep in mind, the Obama administration wasn't exactly spotlessly clean when it came to conducting surveillance on mainstream journalists, including Fox News reporters. However, this is the thing. Back when the Obama administration was considering what to do with the Assange case, they absolutely flatly rejected the option of a criminal charge under that Espionage Act. The reason why is, once again, the Espionage Act of 1917 pretty much was made as a political weapon to go after people against what the United States was up to at that time. So, Obama kind of punted on it. He passed on it. The reason why, too, is keep in mind, once you engage somebody like a Julian Assange who has, from a whistleblower, that's the Obama administration's findings, thus the pardon, from a whistleblower, disclosing information from a whistleblower as a journalist protects you, at least here in the court of law. Now, in the United Kingdom, it's a little different. They do have some secrecy acts and things like that that can get you in trouble. As a matter of fact, one of the funniest things about the UK is that you can't use footage of their House of Commons on television if you're just going to be doing a little bit of political commentary or comedy around it. So, kind of explains why the Daily Show UK fell apart. Anyway, going after somebody in the Espionage Act sets up a very slimy, slippery, hard-to-grasp slope towards endangering freedom of the press. But with these actions, the last Thursday of filing the 17 new charges under that Espionage Act. The Attorney General William Barr and the President of the United States have basically decided to try to see how far they can go. Now think about that for a sec. Under an act written over 100 years ago, the United States Attorney General is trying to set up a way of weaponizing his department under the guidance of his president against the First Amendment rights held United States media. Now, this is going to be a very weird precedent going forward. The reason why is because right now, all over the world, journalism in large has been under the attack. You can't forget things like China officials arresting people and locking them up for journalism. Russia actually adopting Donald Trump's fake news to talk about their own dissenting press. Now, Saudi Arabia's crown prince basically ordered the murder of a Washington Post journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, and has not suffered any consequences at all from the Trump administration. So you see, this isn't just the usual kind of affair. The United States, once the paradise of free press, is now in court through this case trying to establish that any journalist can be prosecuted for receiving or publishing classified information. Now, the government routinely kind of overclassifies stuff just as it's always better to have too much than too little classification. So if a journalist was able to get their hands on a slightly redacted version and publish that ahead of it coming out, well, you could basically be at a risk of being prosecuted for that. Let's say that you find out a bunch of information that isn't relevant or integral to national security, and you disclose that. Under this kind of slippery slope, that also means that people like William Barr and Donald Trump, and honestly, here's the thing, it would set a precedent, so every president after this would be able to do it as well. It would allow them to weaponize the Department of Justice against political enemies within the media. And this is something that the United States should really take a pause on and consider carefully given our history of this. And when you want to talk about the history of this, we have to talk about John Peter Zenger. Now, of course, you have no idea who that is, but his trial basically set up the principles that this country was founded on as far as free and open media. Let me explain. There was at one point in the colony of New York and New Jersey this very corrupt governor. His name was, ironically, Bill Cosby. William S. Cosby, the corrupt royal governor of this territory, took land from the Indians, overtaxed people, called him an idiot. I mean, Zenger basically took all of this outrage against this Bill Cosby. Weird how that name just comes up in history among bad people. But this Bill Cosby basically was doing a lot of harm, so Zenger made up a bunch of pamphlets calling him out on him and was promptly arrested. Now, the thing is that the authors of some of these pieces that Zenger published were anonymous, and Zenger wouldn't name them. So in 1733, he was accused of libel. Now, this is a term that's basically back in those days, you published information that was opposed to the government, not falsifying information against somebody else that causes some sort of harm. No, this form of libel specifically was literature against the government. Now, the first jury was packed with people on Cosby's payroll. Zenger's wife, Anna, during the whole time, kept those presses rolling, and reports from the trial resulted in that payroll jury being kicked out and getting a whole new jury of Zenger's peers. Now, the trial began. Zenger's lawyers started to encounter a lot of problems. Andrew Hamilton of Philadelphia was the defender, and when he admitted that Zenger printed the charges and demanded the prosecution to prove them false, Hamilton basically said, look, it is not the cause of one poor printer, but the cause of liberty. Basically, the judge ordered the jury to convict Zenger if they believe he printed the stories. However, the jury came back in less than 10 minutes with a verdict of not guilty. And the reason why was because they had simply had enough of the jury, of the media at that time in the United States colonies, or I should say just the colonies of the North American British. Well, you get the picture. Look, in pre-New York, New York, they basically took a stand and said, we don't want a media that is complicit and obedient to the government. We want a free and open press that reflects our value. And Zenger, far better than Julian Assange, was something that everybody rallied around. And of course, once he was found not guilty, this set off a huge fight between the British and the American colonists, which was one of the small things that led up to the Revolutionary War and found its way directly into the Bill of Rights under the First Amendment. You see, before the First Amendment was something that Thomas Jefferson scribbled down because he thought, whoa, Constitution seems a little thin here. Before that was something that was scribed down, it was written in the hearts and minds of all of those colonists who had read about the exploit of Zenger's trial. Zenger's trial established the American attitude towards freedom of press. It also inspired the UK that once they were done with the Revolutionary War, they would write up new laws in their country that restricted how their media could cover their government. Now, of course, as the UK evolved, those laws got slimmer and slimmer. However, all the way up through the 20th century, the United States was seen as the best place for journalism and journalistic protection under law. UK was kind of in second place. Now, though, it seems that we could be retrying the whole Zenger trial again. Almost 300 years later, the UK and the United States are going to face off on the issue of what is journalism, what is good content, what is illegal content, and at the end of the day, can you go after somebody for merely saying bad things about the current administration? Wouldn't it be funny? Just think about this for a sec. Wouldn't this be funny if it turned out that all of this infighting results in the United States being the one that has less journalistic protection than the United Kingdom? After all of this time, the tables have turned, and now the United States are the ones saying, you can't say this because it doesn't look good on us. That's it. Now, of course, nobody knows which way this is going to go for now, but a lot of legal experts say that the United States has learned some pretty harsh lessons the last time it tried to extradite somebody from the United Kingdom. And as such, they are dumbing their case way, way, way down. They've crafted this basically to go up to the line, but not cross what most people in Donald Trump's base would consider a constitutional concern. They're also not resolving the issue or status of Julian Assange. Is he journalism? Is he just internet troll? But one thing will come out very, very soon. Whatever happens at the conclusion of Julian Assange's trial, if he gets extradited to the United States, if he gets brought up in front of a court here in the United States, and if they are able to hold him to any one of these espionage acts, the history of free media will record this as the day it died. This will be on the tombstone of a free and open press. Because think about it. Julian Assange was basically, as far as Trump said, and Trump's team, accused of giving Manning a password and then setting up a place for the information that Manning collected to be dropped off. Now, first things first, nobody can actually prove the password thing. It's just kind of thrown in there to sound bad. But remember Watergate and how everybody had drop spot? You know, Deep Throat and all those informants didn't really go to the journalists and be like, "Hi, I'm here for my 4:30 rat out the president appointment." No, they had drop zones, places where people would hide messages and put them in, you know, public enclosures. Does this sound like the internet? Because that could be what Julian Assange is as a journalist doing. Just setting up a digital drop spot. And that is protected under the First Amendment. But is he a good guy to rally behind? Not in the slightest. Ugh. But we have to. The future of Assange is the future of free and open press here in the United States. And there's no two ways about it. Coming back, we have got a lot more to cover. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
Get informed. This is the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back. Ooh, if you missed any part of the first part of our show, well, what are you waiting for? You can go back and listen to it immediately after this on the iHeart app, Spotify, iTunes. Just look for the Shaggy Jenkins Show. You can also find me on social media at Shaggy Live. Now, where were we? Oh, yeah. Trump and the Chinese. Hey, this is a weird fight going on. You got to admit, because for the most part, a lot of people think that Donald Trump is actually unaware of who pays tariffs. And on the other side of that, you have actual people that work with the president that are telling the media in anonymous disclosures that the president absolutely thinks that China pays the tariffs, not the United States consumer. But one of the weirdest fights that Trump has had involves a tech company called Huawei, okay? They are the ones that make very, very cheap communications equipment. Not too long ago, some of their technology was found to have a little bit of a backdoor in for hackers to gain access to areas where their equipment was installed. Now, this led to a little bit of an uproar amongst Canadian as well as United States diplomats at the Chinese and outright bans against the company and its technology were issued. Problem. That technology is very cheap and has been widely available for a long time. And as such, small carriers have been using it to provide cell service to rural American home. A lot of the heartland, in fact, has its cell service exclusively through Huawei's technology. They make towers, they make the transmitters, and in a lot of places they manufacture some of the chips that were in those cheap phones that people get in smaller, less affluent neighborhoods across the Rust Belt. Now, the United States is put an outright ban on using that type of technology. And some inside the tech industry would say, well, good on you, because look at what they were accused of when they were accused of it rather recently. And let's just go ahead and err on the side of caution. But erring on the side of caution is also over $1 billion investment for ISPs and cell providers that do not have that money. Now, think about it this way. The United States government said that this equipment is banned. So, to that end, every bit of service that is carried on that technology has to have a kill date on it. That kill date is pretty soon. And the problem is that the United States government has only ponied up about $700 million in a relief grant to these rural providers to update their equipment and replace the, you know, banned Chinese equipment. All insider estimates say that that job is going to cost $800 million or over $1 billion to actually complete. And in the meantime, because there is a kill date on all this technology, a lot of areas along the rural part of the United States, those wide open spaces, the spaces where miles and miles exist, they are no longer going to be within cell service again. And I know. Right now our government is trying to take all our laws back to the 1930s, but let's not go back to the Telecommunications Act of 1934, can we? That's where it's heading, though. With these rural areas losing service, a lot of people that rely on their cell service for 911 and emergency services, as well as keeping in contact with their doctors because they have managed conditions that do need updates and sometimes immediate care or consultation from their primary care physician, they are going to be without cell service. So I know what you're asking. What's the compromise? Well, you know, we can't just keep using this technology. It's been banned. And rightfully so, Shaggy. Well, okay. Yeah, I kind of see that. And at the same time, I also see how American greed and the want to do more for less kind of led us down this whole path to begin with. Face it, if we didn't like all those cheap Chinese goods, we wouldn't buy so many of them. And that's why stores like Walmart and all kinds of places that provide those quote-unquote cheap things are now experiencing a 25% jump in price. It has to do with the tariff. But while everybody is looking at the tariff fight with China, nobody is really looking at the telecommunications fight on it. China has the ability to make electronics for telecommunications very quickly and very cheaply. They have a huge manufacturing center specifically for tech items just like that. On the other hand, China is a communist nation that has been known to install certain backdoors in their hardware unbeknownst to the people they are selling these products to for use in state surveillance campaigns of foreign country. Okay, so yeah. It's kind of a hard debate to pick which side you're on. But the fact of the matter remains, thanks to Donald Trump and China and this crazy trade war that we found ourselves in, tens of thousands of Americans will be losing coverage in their local area. And for people that work remotely, let's say you have a large acreage farm operation, you're miles away from home on your equipment when something breaks down, or worse, you break down, whip out your phone, and no service could be in your future. And that's just one thing to consider as time goes on when it comes to the United States and technology. Are we going to continue to rely on foreign countries for this, or are we going to take an initiative, invest in the education infrastructure here, and yes, that includes free college, to make ourselves more 21st century ready? I guess it doesn't go without saying, over the weekend I had read an article from the UK press that compared the United States to a third world country right now as far as our technology infrastructure and our ability to manufacture and export. Plus with our draconian laws against the female anatomy. But something we really should consider is with this whole big bubble that's about to pop thanks to the United States' reliance on foreign countries and their cheap exports, fueling our infrastructure How long before we realize we need to reinvest here? And China is the worst country right now to talk about reinvesting in infrastructure. President Winnie the Pooh himself, Xi Jinping, president for life of China, has famously invested some $40 billion United States dollars in something called the Belt and Roadway Package. This is a huge infrastructure package that creates economic zones along the Chinese and whatever country they touch border, which allows for free trade to exist even in communist China or within the communist China control. These economic zones are paired up with a large, massive highway and railway package that is supposed to make it easier for for China to transport goods across its territory from Europe to Asia, thus making it a vital path for trade in the Northern Hemisphere, the largest, in fact, at the completion of the Belt and Roadway Package. That $40 billion price tag should sound familiar to us in the United States, though. That's the exact amount that Donald Trump pledged to increase military spending. Remember when he did that and he said, "This is good for us. I've increased the spending in China." We didn't report on this a whole lot. China responded by saying, "You keep building militaries, we'll keep building economy." And it looks like that prediction is coming true. With failing infrastructure in the United States and a president who will not talk about it, he'll use the infrastructure debate as drumming up his base of saying, "I'm trying to do good," and then also use it to say something bad about the Democrats when he storms out of these meetings for unrelated to infrastructure reasons. Now, of course, Donald Trump did come out later and say, "Well, I'm willing to work with the Democrats on some things. Maybe infrastructure will be one of them." But because of his reluctance to actually have a bipartisan effort and look at the failing infrastructure in the United States, that $40 billion investment that China made could swamp our economy for decades to come. Their $40 billion invested in infrastructure will pay off massive dividends in the United States. $40 billion investment in infrastructure is barely scratching the barrel of the water issues here in our country. Now, I'm not comparing apples to oranges here between a communist regime and a democracy. Or a democracy in name only, as it seems like we're down that path to a far, far right kind of government lately. But when it comes to who spent what where and what the dividends pay off for, the United States spent their money, after they saved it on buying all those cheap Chinese goods, on the military. The Chinese spent it on a huge infrastructure program and PR campaign saying how great their infrastructure program was for Europe and Asia. The United States, unless it very seriously starts to consider how China is going to beat us, will be beaten. Blindly going down tariff path, blindly going down sanctions path without looking at our own domestic investment. Now, I'm not saying the money's got to come from military spending where Donald Trump sent it. But sooner or later, the United States is going to have a bipartisan effort to seriously address the infrastructure here and its consequences towards our economy. Because if we were to invest in, say, a massive highway and rail system between Canada and Mexico, we could establish a corridor here in the United States that could bring us economic wealth for years to come. But of course, that runs headfirst into the immigration issue and the how much we hate Canadians for their free healthcare issue. Pick and choose your battles, people. Pick and choose. Because we're losing. At least on the infrastructure front. Now, as long as we're talking about China, can we say that China might have burned the United States in a completely all new way. Because as long as we're talking about technology and 5G and Huawei, the company that's all under scrutiny, a China state-run media outlet used a clip from The Daily Show's Trevor Noah, the segment called If You Don't Know, Now You Know, talking about this whole thing with the equipment maker being dominant in 5G mobile technology. Well, that clip was used in state media to basically say, look how great we are, because you know what? Famous American talk show host says this relentless suppression of Hawaii is because we possess advanced 5G technology while American 5G lags far behind. Now, I know Trevor Noah probably never intended this, but they ran this clip where Noah said, and right now the best 5G technology is made by a Chinese company called Huawei. While America is developing its own, 5G in China is far ahead. They're basically going to set the trends. So this is a race many people are already saying America has lost. Of course, when approached for a statement, nobody from Comedy Central was available. But think about it this way. With all of this debate on where our technology is coming from, who's developing it, and how we use that technology or invest in our own infrastructure and plans of education to make sure that we can manufacture our own technology, well, we're always going to lag behind. Moving on, let's talk about Adam Schiff, shall we? This is the guy that basically sits in the House. He's a known opponent of Donald Trump and his agenda of stonewalling the House investigation. And it seems like he's really, really hawkish on the Russian story. Specifically, the Mueller investigation, Russian collusion, and things like that. There might be a reason why. You see, a long time ago in a country far away called the United States of America, there was this weird day in 1984 where two Soviet officials met at an airport. In addition to the usual FBI surveillance team, there was about 20 more agents trying to track the movement of this third guy. His name was Alexander Gershin. Now, he's an accredited diplomat and an inside known Soviet intelligence officer. So when the Soviet officials entered the airport with FBI agents watching, he detached himself to make a call at a payphone. Now, hundreds of miles down the coast, the FBI counterintelligence agency received that call. And in coded Russian, they had heard that they had an acquaintance they were going to fly to Europe that October. Now, this acquaintance was an FBI agent who, out of greed, desperation, spite, what have you, had begun an affair with a woman on the other end of that call that the FBI was listening on. Her name was Okay, it's a long name. But the thing is that as a part of his affair, he agreed that he was going to sell classified information to the then communist Soviet government. And this was a huge problem for the United States that was at a huge, huge Cold War with them. Now, Schiff, who is more familiar as a chairman of the House Intelligence Committee back then, was a young U.S. attorney in Los Angeles. And he was the one that eventually, after 6 years and three trials, mind you, finally able to secure Richard W. Miller's conviction. He was a 47-year-old Los Angeles-based counterintelligence on the Bureau's Soviet squad and the first FBI agent ever convicted of espionage. Now, the thing is about this is trade. Of spy craft, shall we call it. It's something that each country has a particular fingerprint on. And Russia is very, very sophisticated in their spying. So when it comes to all of their machinations and stuff, you kind of have to have somebody that has a long-standing long-standing view of it, like Schiff, to realize how they use it, where they use it, and to what end. Because during this whole affair, this whole Mueller trial that Schiff was involved in, he learned how the Russians operate. He learned how they target people, what vulnerabilities they look in those people that they target, what kind of information that others are looking for, how they can get access to that information. They look for people who are kind of out on the margin of their job that have financial problems. Maybe they have marital problems. Maybe they even have plumbing problems. When it comes to how Russia works, much like the case of Richard Mueller, Schiff might be on the scent of how they have made Donald Trump into their, if not willing agent, at least asset. Now, long have we discussed things like the Steele dossier and Donald Trump's various real estate dealings within Moscow. But when it comes to the other side of that equation, we very rarely talk in this country about how the Russians would even do something like making a United States president an asset, either willingly or just through simple coercion and stroking of ego. See, for that, we need somebody that has an understanding. And when it comes to the House, right now, Schiff is it. He's seen this firsthand through the Mueller trial, methodically broken down how Russia, at that time a communist government, but really ain't a dang thing changed with the FSB versus KGB monikers. They're still the same type of country. He learned all the ways that they work, how they gather this thing called kompromat, which is material that they use to blackmail people, and how that blackmail is used for political gain when Russia finds itself in either economic or diplomatic trouble. But here's the thing. When Schiff sent his letter to Barr back on May 8th, demanding all documents and materials, regardless a form or classification, this was kind of a bigger swipe than people realize. See, we take it as, on the outside, depending on what side of the political spectrum you're on, either House oversight, once again, trying to look into the president and the president's stonewalling, or if you're on the other side of the political aisle, you look at this as yet another guy trying to go after Donald Trump and digging any which way he can to find dirt on him. But the actual truth of the matter might be is that the guy doing the looking right now might actually know what he's looking for and might actually be the one person who can find it. Because Soviets are not blunt. They are nuanced. They are subtle. I think the best thing that you could say about a Russian agent is you can never see them until they've already left your side. But when it came to Schiff and his experience with all of that, it's armored him in his battle with Bill Barr. Because the Justice Department basically said, you know what? No, we're not going to do that. And then on May 21st, they came out and said, yeah, okay, we'll give you some access, but it's kind of a temporary access. It's tentative. We'll have to talk more about it later. Now, he's also asked for a briefing by the Justice Department on the FBI's counterintelligence probe into Trump Russia, which began before the Mueller's probe. But the status is currently unclear. The reason why is because all of these things look familiar to a man that's been there before. But at that time, it was the intelligence community. This time, it's the government. Back then, Schiff worked with the intelligence guys to root out their bad guy. Now he works in the government, trying to make sure that we don't have any of those skeletons in his closet. And I know a lot of people would say that, you know, Schiff has the potential to be that man, but here's the thing. When you talk about enemies of the president, and let's just jump back here. Can Adam Schiff pull off a Jack Brooks? You remember him if you're well old enough to remember Watergate. He served in the House of Representatives for 42 years. His Congress term spanned that of 10 presidents. Now, he was in JFK's motorcade when it was shot. Brooks stood beside the close friend, Lyndon B. Johnson, when he took the oath of office on the Air Force One. He was the guy in politics back then. But he was also the worst enemy of one person. You see, he was a member, not even the chairman, of the House Judiciary Committee. He's the guy that wrote the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. Nixon resigned before that House could vote on it, but the impeachment article themselves need to be more than just a footnote to Watergate. Because when you look at them, you look at their author, his disposition towards the president at that time, and towards preserving the sanctity of the American government system. Brooks went above and beyond in writing these articles. And so, when you talk about impeachment now, a lot of people are saying, well, all these people are just drawing up willy-nilly impeachments. Okay, well, that's been the case for every president ever. Let's not forget, Obama had senators and House of Representatives write up articles of impeachment on him. So did George W. Bush. Bill Clinton actually had articles of impeachment served on him. And then George H.W. Bush, you get the picture, right? Just because you write the articles of impeachment don't mean that they're going to be voted on or actually worked upon. As a matter of fact, if the House goes for impeachment on this cycle, Mitch McConnell has already come out and said, we'll kill it in the Senate. And that might be why Nancy Pelosi and House Dems aren't going down impeachment, because they realized the Senate would have to weigh in on it, and the Senate is firmly in the pocket. But Brooks, back then, under a heavy Republican Congress that supported their president, hook, line, and sinker in the elections that he had just won, knew that he had to write something big. So, when he wrote his impeachment articles, he made sure that it had everything in it. The tapes, the break-in, every smoking gun, every confession, every little missive that was put out in the media, he had it in the article. And at the end of the day, if we can't get this through investigation and we have to go down the route of impeachment, maybe we need to take a lesson from Jack Brooks. And maybe we should listen to Adam Schiff a little bit more seriously about this whole Russia thing. Till tomorrow, take care of yourselves. Love you, mean it. Get in, bye.